And welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 23rd, 2021. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline is States Campuses Vaccinate Thousands by Vanessa Miller. Iowa universities and colleges are vaccinating students, faculty, and staff in droves using massive clinics and scheduled appointments in hopes of honoring their promise of having a more traditional semester this fall. Quote, "It's a lot easier than having to figure out a time between work and classes to drive somewhere," University of Iowa junior Isabel Hauslog, 21, said about the on-campus clinic in the Iowa Memorial Union while she sat Wednesday through her obligatory 15-minute post-vaccine wait. Hauslog is taking 18 credit hours working and has plenty on her plate with final exams approaching. Making the option of popping into the IMU for a pair of shots spaced 3 weeks apart was much easier than trying to find an appointment elsewhere. Because Hauslog's hometown in nearby North Liberty, she wasn't worried about needing the two-shot vaccine after federal regulators recently paused the use of the one-dose Johnson & Johnson option due to concerns over rare side effects. And she was excited to get it, sailing through the IMU setup where dozens of UI student health workers and volunteers doled out hundreds of shots, Band-Aids, and vaccination cards throughout the 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Wednesday clinic. "If the opportunity arose around here," Hauslog said, referring to the UI campus, "I was going to jump on it, so I was excited." The UI campus repeated its clinic Thursday, expecting to vaccinate close to 2,000 students over the next 2 days. Iowa State University this week and next also is offering first-dose clinics on campus with follow-up shot clinics scheduled throughout May. Its mass vaccination site is the campus's state gym, with shifts running from 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Preliminary calculations indicate ISU could vaccinate over 2,000 students a day. And the University of Northern Iowa held its campus vaccination clinics last week. UNI, however, had to cancel its first event, meant specifically for students wanting the single-shot dose. Kirkwood Community College, holding on-campus clinics this week for students, faculty, and staff by appointment, announced Thursday it's expanding access to walk-ins from the public. Starting Thursday afternoon and continuing while supplies last, anyone over 16 wanting the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine could go to the Michael J. Gould Recreation Center on the Kirkwood main campus in Cedar Rapids with a valid ID to start the vaccination process. A clinic there runs from 8 a.m. to noon and 1 to 4 p.m. today. The UI clinic, too, reported capacity to handle more students wanting a shot, according to UI Student Health Director Paul Natvig. Though initial guidance mandated people get their first and second doses in the same place, potentially complicating the two-shot process for students planning to head out of town after classes end, Natvig said people now can get first and second doses in different locations. Some might, he said, although UI Student Health expects to be relatively busy for its second-shot clinics in May. UI freshman Talia Van Setten said she's planning to return to the IMU for her follow-up. She was happy to have the chance to get it there, even though she hates needles. "I try not to look," a clinic worker told Van Setten as she braced for the poke. "I'm scared of needles," Van Setten said, "but I wanted the vaccine. I really, truly did want it, and it's nice that Iowa's actually offering us a chance to get it done here on campus. Because I don't have a car right now, I can't just drive out somewhere and get it done." The next story is ACLU Renews Fight Over Transgender Healthcare by Michaela Ram. In another salvo against the state, in its years-long battle on behalf of transgender Iowans, the ACLU of Iowa announced Thursday it is suing over a state law that bans Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming surgeries. The civil liberties group filed the lawsuit in Polk County District Court on behalf of two transgender Iowans, alleging a law excluding transition-related surgeries from public insurance funds is unconstitutional and a violation of the Iowa Civil Rights Act. This is the third time the ACLU of Iowa has filed lawsuits against the state for policies that prevent Medicaid coverage of medically necessary treatment for transgender Iowans, the ACLU officials told reporters Thursday. Quote, "We are frustrated. Clients are frustrated, and we know Iowans are frustrated that the state keeps reviving this discriminatory rule," unquote, said Rita Bettis Austin, ACLU of Iowa legal director. The lawsuit seeks to strike down a law passed by the 2019 Iowa legislature that amended the Iowa Civil Rights Act to allow any state or local government entity to decline to use public insurance, including Medicaid, to pay for the transition-related surgeries. The lawsuit is a reiteration of an earlier lawsuit filed by ACLU of Iowa on behalf of the Aiden Vasquez of Central Iowa and Micah Covington of Southeast Iowa, who both are transgender and qualify for Medicaid. That earlier lawsuit was thrown out by the Iowa Court of Appeals in August 2020. The court did not uphold the law, but because neither individual had been denied Medicaid coverage under the new rule yet, the dispute was speculative, according to the court. Vasquez since has been denied coverage for transition-related care, Bettis Austin said. She added that Covington will join the lawsuit if she also is denied Medicaid coverage. Quote, "It's hard knowing that the state has gone out of its way to discriminate against me and block my medical care just because I'm transgender, when other Iowans on Medicaid are able to get coverage for the surgeries they need," unquote, Vasquez said in a statement. Both Iowans are seeking the care to treat gender dysphoria or the distress or discomfort that may occur in individuals whose gender identity differs from their physical characteristics. While others may seek other forms of gender affirmation, medical and surgical avenues are common types of gender-affirming care. Gender dysphoria can result in serious risk factors, including depression, anxiety, and an increased risk of death by suicide. Vasquez said being unable to access that medical care, quote, "has threatened my mental well-being. I am a man, but in a body that does not reflect who I am," he said. "That's why this surgery will be life-changing," unquote. Major medical groups, including the American Medical Association and the American Psychological Association, agree that transition-related surgeries and other care are medically necessary when prescribed by a doctor. Quote, "Being able to finally get the surgery that my doctors have determined is medically necessary for me will do nothing less than give me my life back," Covington said in a statement. "It will help me build a life in which my body is in harmony with my gender, so I can overcome the depression, lack of confidence, isolation, and other problems my gender dysphoria causes," unquote. The measure was passed as an amendment to health budget bill at the end of the 2019 legislative session. That rule was in direct response to an Iowa Supreme Court decision in March 2018 that struck down an administrative code that restricted Medicaid dollars for gender-affirming surgeries. In their ruling, the justices held that denying Medicaid reimbursement for surgeries to treat gender dysphoria violates protections under the Iowa Civil Rights Act. The act has outlawed discrimination on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation since 2007. The ruling was a first, and was a first by the state Supreme Court affirming rights of the transgender Iowans under the Iowa Civil Rights Act, according to officials with ACLU of Iowa at the time. The organization filed the lawsuit in 2017 on behalf of two other Iowans, Carol Ann Beal and Ariana Good, who were denied coverage for gender-affirming surgeries by their managed care organizations, the insurance companies that administer the state's Medicaid program. ACLU of Iowa also has been involved in previous litigation against private insurers for access to gender-affirming surgeries and represented a transgender Iowan who won a discrimination lawsuit against the state in early 2019. Jesse Vroey, a former Iowa Department of Corrections nurse who identifies as a male, filed suit alleging the health insurance plan for Iowa's public employees contained a specific exclusion for transition-related surgeries. The lawsuit also alleged the department had denied his request to use the men's restrooms and locker rooms at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women, where he worked. In ruling in his favor, a jury awarded Vroey $120,000 in damages. Cedar Rapids Virtual Academy expands by Grace King. The Cedar Rapids Community School District is expanding its virtual academy to all K-12 grades, hiring the first principal to oversee the school next year. The COVID-19 pandemic accelerated the district's timeline to make the academy available to all students after offering temporary virtual learning this year. The academy previously was available only to middle and high school students. New Academy Principal Ernie Cox said the virtual school is an example of a durable model of education that will continue to grow in part because of the pandemic. Expanding the Cedar Rapids Virtual Academy provides two learning options to students for the 2021-22 school year. Families can choose to enroll their children in traditional in-person learning or in the academy, which is virtual. Teacher-led instruction. Students also are able to sign up for activities and sports in their resident school. The virtual academy is not the same as temporary virtual learning, which many students have been enrolled in throughout the pandemic for health and safety reasons. Registration for the virtual academy still is open, but Cox said he expects between 200 and 400 students. Virtual Academy students will have the opportunity to go on in-person field trips. Quote, I envision classes going to museums and incorporating that into our school experience, and even go out and serve their community and learn with other people. That's a big piece I'm excited about, Cox said. The district expects students from across Iowa, maybe in smaller districts that don't offer virtual learning options, to enroll in its program. To be successful in this program, students might need a dedicated home learning space and be able to navigate the demands of online learning, such as keeping track of when a teacher will be teaching live, where archived lessons can be found, and what assignments need to be done, Cox said. Particularly with younger students, is there someone who will be in the home environment who can help if there is a technology or Wi-Fi issue? Cox asked. The district will work with families to provide a home internet connection if they don't already have one. Elementary and middle school students in the virtual academy will have live instruction daily with a teacher and some independent work. Core subjects, as well as art, music, and physical education, will all be included in the curriculum, Cox said. High school students will have a variety of options, including advanced placement, world language, and other extracurricular classes, Cox said. We wouldn't do this if it wasn't something we thought was a need or desire in Cedar Rapids, Cox said. Next month, the academy will begin making staffing decisions, Cox said. The district is looking forward to engaging teachers in the virtual academy who have found temporary online learning to be a great experience. In addition to leading the academy, Cox will continue his other role as principal at Madison Elementary School. Elementary teachers with the virtual academy will have dedicated space at Madison to work, Cox said. My home will still be Madison, Cox said. This will make life a little more manageable. I'm in classes all day in the building, and next year part of my day will be visiting virtual classes and seeing how kids are engaging and being present. People want this, he continued. They've seen it work this year, and our teachers have been difference makers. Having Cedar Rapids teachers design and deliver virtual learning this year has made a great case for how this could work. Turning to page 2, former pro boxer says he knew his longtime friend killed James Buer, by Trish Mahaffey. A former Cedar Rapids pro boxer who turned to methamphetamine years after his career ended testified Thursday that his friend, Matthew Robbins, didn't completely admit to fatally shooting James Buer in 2014, but what Robbins did say made him believe that something bad happened. Robert Bleakley, who became a pro boxer in 1992 and had 127 fights during his career, testified Thursday that Robbins asked him to come to his farmhouse in Ely on June 1, 2014, the day after Buer, 51, of Marion, was killed. He said Robbins was acting strange and told him, "Crazy SH happened out here last night," which Bleakley understood as someone was raped or killed. Robbins, 48, is on trial in federal court in Cedar Rapids, accused of robbing and fatally shooting Buer, a drug dealer, on May 31, 2014. He is charged with robbery affecting interstate commerce, conspiracy to commit robbery affecting interstate commerce, and using, carrying, and brandishing a firearm during a crime of violence resulting in murder. Robbins' trial started Tuesday, with testimony resuming Monday. Bleakley testified that during his June 1st visit, he saw Robbins pulling up the carpet in the living room and that Robbins said the dog had urinated on it. Danielle Bush, Robbins' ex-girlfriend, testified Tuesday that Buer was fatally shot in the living room and blood was on the carpet. She said she lured Buer to Robbins' house so William Yancey, also charged in Buer's death, and Robbins could do something about Buer because he was cutting the meth he sold to Robbins with bath salts, reducing the quality of the drugs. Bleakley said he returned to the farmhouse the next day, June 2nd, when Robbins called him. Bleakley said he went out behind the house and found Robbins in the fire pit, shoveling ashes into garbage bags. Robbins loaded the 4 or 5 bags into Bleakley's vehicle, and they drove to the Palisades Kepler State Park boat ramp. He washed Robbins wade out with each bag and dumped them into the river. He again asked Robbins what had happened, and Robbins said, "If he wasn't selling bath salts, he wouldn't be missing," end quote. Later, Robbins told Bleakley he had cracked him, making a gesture of holding a gun, and said the body was gone. Bleakley admitted he had lied to a grand jury hearing evidence in Buer's slaying because Robbins had told him he'd be in a lot of trouble if he told what he knew. Bleakley said he and Robbins had been friends for more than 30 years. He didn't want to testify at Robbins' trial, but he did because it has been horrible living with what he knew for 7 years. Andrew Shaw also testified Robbins admitted to killing Buer while they were both housed in the Iowa County Jail in Marengo. Shaw told Robbins he knew what had happened to Buer, but that Robbins at first denied it. Later, when they were watching a television news report on Buer, Robbins said, "Yeah, I did it, but you already know the truth," unquote. Shaw was convicted last year of running a large marijuana trafficking ring that supplied marijuana to Chris Bagley and the two men charged with killing Bagley over drug robberies from Shaw. Sonnets and Shakespeare in Iowa City and Virtually by Diana Nolan. During the month of his birth, Riverside Theater has been celebrating England's finest playwright, not for his rich tapestry of dramas, comedies, and histories, but for his lesser-known writings, his poetry. While William Shakespeare's exact birth date in April 1564 remains unknown, it commonly is celebrated April 23rd, which also was the date of his death in 1616 at 52. So, from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. today, Riverside Theater's artists will gather in downtown Iowa City to stage a free marathon reading of the Bard of Avon's 154 sonnets. The temperatures might not make actors and audiences compare it to a summer's day, but the event should smell as sweet, whether viewers are listening at the Weather Dance Fountain on the pedestrian mall or via live stream on social media. In a separate sonnet celebration, ticketed audiences have until 11:59 p.m. Sunday to see a modern take on this poetic art form through Riverside Theater's riveting virtual production of Sonnets for an Old Century, published in 2000. This online version clocks in just under 2 hours, but the time flees swiftly as 23 of the corridor's finest actors journey to a mystical space suspended in the magical mist between life and death. Their world is created in the best marriage of green screen technology and stagecraft, where Rob Merritt and S. Benjamin Farrar have filmed each actor separately and then woven them into a fairyland setting that makes them look almost elfin. Written by Jose Rivera in anthology form, where the actors perform unrelated monologues, the themes and issues sound like they were written yesterday, not 20 years ago. Bullying, racial strife, gun violence, weapons in schools, life, death, dreams, desires, parenting, prison, family, sin, all are examined, some with an unexpected gut punch, others with a world-weary heart. And thankfully, a couple are funny. Patrick Delaney, as Gino Silva, is nearly unrecognizable behind chunky Martin Scorsese glasses. His attitude is hilarious as he pouts about an episode of identity theft in the physical, not financial sense. Rachel Lindhardt is feisty as Esther recounting her short political run. Carly Myers is heartbreaking as Anna, plumbing the depths of despair over an incident that haunts her soul. And Tiara Plowden is shattering as Dawn, describing through tears how tornadoes full of old hatreds are taking her to some anti-Oz where the yellow brick roads red with blood. Everyone's fate hangs in the balance of these words, flung into the universe, waiting and deserving to be heard. Cedar Rapids, Linn County, Look at How to Better Respond to Disasters, by Gage Meskimen. Lynn County and other cities in the county are looking to improve on disaster response after last year's derecho swept through eastern Iowa, leaving almost all of the county's residents without power and access to information. The city and the county on Thursday announced a countywide community resilience project to, quote, build on expertise and success in times of disaster, unquote, and integrate, quote, new learning in exercises and planning, according to a news release. The project will be led by Collective Clarity, a Cedar Rapids consulting firm headed by Leslie Wright, a former executive with United Way of East Central Iowa. The project will develop exercises and simulations that anticipate disasters. Experts and citizens will be consulted in preparing the plan, which will be updated yearly to reflect changes in the environment, the release said. The project will provide communication strategies that can be used during disasters, including making use of informal networks to share real-time information. Those strategies also will be practiced annually. Cedar Rapids and Linn County are splitting the $30,000 cost for the 6-month planning and design process, which will include production of simulation materials and supporting documents, the city's communications division manager Maria Johnson told the Gazette. Marion and Ely also are participating, as is the East Central Iowa Council of Governments, which represents small community interests, Johnson said. Cedar Rapids Mayor Brad Hart said the project provides an opportunity to enhance partnerships and work together as a community to prepare and understand each agency's role in a disaster. He said the project will incorporate findings from the city's internal after-action report, which the city contracted for in March to assess the city's response to the August 10th derecho. The report, being prepared by Tennessee-based Atchison Consulting Service at an estimated cost of $25,000, is expected to be available by midsummer. It will be used as a roadmap for disaster planning, the city has said. Quote, the derecho shined a bright light on the systemic inequities that have always existed for certain groups of people in our community, unquote, Linn County Supervisor Stacy Walker said. While some aspects of the local government response were laudable, he said, we must own the fact that there are improvements to be made. Hospitalizations hit 2-month high by Gage Miskimen. COVID-19 hospitalizations in Iowa increased to 235 Thursday, up from 219 the day before, and the highest that number has been in more than 2 months. It was February 20th when COVID-19 hospitalizations were at 238 in Iowa. The number of patients in intensive care increased from 54 to 56 Thursday, and the number of patients on ventilators increased from 20 to 24. The state Thursday also reported 497 new virus cases. The new numbers bring the state's total to 361,811 since March 2020, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Iowa's 7-day average for new cases was 448. Linn County added 29 cases in the 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Thursday. The new cases bring the county's total to 20,414. Linn's 7-day average for new cases is 25. In Johnson County, 32 new cases were reported for a total of 14,186 since March of 2020. The 7-day average is 31. As of Thursday afternoon, 894,041 Iowans were fully vaccinated against COVID-19, up more than 18,600 from Wednesday's total. That's 28.34% of all Iowans and 35.62% of adult Iowans over age 16. The total number of people vaccinated in the state, including non-Iowans, is 930,565. As of Thursday, 2,141,871 doses of the vaccine had been administered in Iowa, up almost 31,000 from Wednesday's total. Of those doses, 2,016,510 have gone to Iowans. In Linn County, 69,035 people are fully vaccinated, up almost 1,700 from Wednesday. That's 38.26% of the adult population and 30.45% of the county's total population. The number of vaccine doses administered in the county as of Thursday afternoon was 161,930, up almost 3,000 from Wednesday's total. In Johnson County, 54,064 people are fully vaccinated. That's 43.49% of the county's adult population and 35.77% of the total population. To date, 126,852 vaccine doses have been administered, up almost 1,500 from Wednesday. The 5 deaths reported Thursday took place between March 14th and April 3rd and bring the state's death toll to 5,904. Of the 5 deaths, 1 was of an individual over 81. 3 were people ages 61 to 80, and 1 was age 18 to 40. Pottawatomie County reported 2 deaths, with Calhoun, Dubuque, and Kossuth counties reporting 1 each. Only 1 outbreak was reported in Iowa long-term care facilities Thursday, with 18 people ill. Since the start of the pandemic, 2,305 people within the facilities have died of the virus. That's 39% of Iowa's death toll. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 23rd, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Martha M. Marty Beckman, Kelowna. Martha M. Beckman, 99, of Kelowna, died Tuesday, April 20th, 2021, at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City following a sudden illness. A memorial service will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial funds may be given to the Kelowna United Methodist Church, Kelowna, the Kelowna Library, or the Kelowna Historical Society. Donations may be sent to the Petersheim Funeral Home at P.O. Box 81, Kelowna, Iowa, 52247. Tranquilino Frank Romero. Tranquilino Frank Romero, 92, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Sunday, April 8, 2021. A public visitation will be held 10 to 11 a.m. Friday, April 23rd, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Following the continued guidance from health officials, physical distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is required. A private family funeral service and burial will follow. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website under the obituary for Frank, under the video tab, starting at 11 a.m. Friday, April 23rd. Marlene A. Evans, Marion. Marlene A. Evans, 81, of Marion, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, April 17, 2021, after a brief illness. A vigil service will be held at 4 p.m. Monday, April 26th, followed by a visitation from 4:30 to 6 p.m. at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral liturgy will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 27th, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Marion, conducted by Deacon Jeff Volker. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. Robert Lee Suila, Watkins. Robert Lee Suila, 73, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, April 20th, 2021, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha with his family at his side. Graveside services will be held for Robert and his wife Sharon at 11 a.m. Saturday, May 8th, at Mound Cemetery in Watkins. In other death notices in Dyersville, Judy Ann Geistkemper, 73, died Thursday, April 22nd, 2021, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. In Marion, Ronald G. Bear Franks, 79, died Wednesday, April 21st, 2021, Papich Cuba Funeral Services in Cedar Rapids. In Tama, Sylvia Lorene Capayu, 85, died Wednesday, April 21st, 2021. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. Tama, Donald W. Wanity Sr., 88, died Wednesday, April 21st, 2021. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. And in West Union, Charles Jacobson, 96, died Friday, April 9th, 2021. Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, West Union. Now turning to the sports page and the Drake Relays. Kennedy's Bartles on Top by Jeff Linder. Dateline Des Moines. It's a nice step, but the Kennedy Cougars insist it's not a final destination. And in the greater scheme of things, it's not enough. Drake is something, but it's not everything, Brody Lovell said. Kennedy's Drew Bartles captured a pair of championships, giving the Cougars a comfortable advantage in the boys' shuttle hurdle relay and following with the 110-meter hurdles title in a condensed one-day high school show at the Drake Relays on Thursday at Drake Stadium. The 110 highs, it wasn't my cleanest race, but I'm not complaining I won, Bartles said. Bartles got out fast in the highs and held off Adam Wright of West Des Moines Dowling, winning in 14.40 seconds. I was just listening to the starter. Once he popped the gun, I just took off, Bartles said. The big thrill came in the shuttle, in which Reed Packabear, Bartles, Max White, and Brody Lovell stormed to a 57.95-second triumph, an effort that ranks number two all-time in Iowa since the hurdles to 36 inches, in 2019. Packabear got the Cougars into gear. I just wanted to get us off to a fast start, he said, and then Bartles blew it open. I usually run second. The philosophy is to build a lead early and let everybody try to chase us, Bartles said. When other teams are chasing, they're more likely to screw up. Bartles and Lovell were on Kennedy's winning shuttle team in 2019. Times like this, we perform, Lovell said. Cedar Rapids Prairies, Adam Longwell, Jeremy Hardaway, Eli Abel, and Siondae Adams were second in 58.56 seconds. Metro competitors earned a pair of runner-up finishes in the throws. Marion's Garrett Wagner was second to Pella's Cody Heisman in the shot put, and Linmar's McKay Jelinek finished behind Woodbine's Lane Pryor in the discus. I'm not happy or satisfied with second, said Wagner, whose 57-foot, 5¾-inch best effort came on his final throw. I wanted it bad, but I still have a lot of time, and I'll see him again at the state meet in 4 weeks. I'm never satisfied. I want to be the top guy. Huseman topped out at 58-7. Jelinek led the discus through the preliminaries. His top throw, 178.9, was his second attempt. Pryor passed him with a 185-footer on his fifth fling. Iowa City Liberty pushed Cedar Falls throughout the 3,200-meter relay. The Tigers were clocked in at 7:53, the Lightning in 7:54. Liberty anchor Bowen Gripp pulled alongside Cedar Falls' T.J. Tomlinovich on the backstretch of the final lap, but Tomlinovich answered. He stayed a couple of steps ahead of me, Gripp said, with about 200 meters to go. I tried to make a move, but his move was better. Gavin Keeney, Jack Kinzer, and Caleb Schillinger ran the first three legs for the Bolts. I looked on the scoreboard and saw our time, and I was very, very pleased, Kinzer said. That's a good time. We'll take it. Iowa City High's Isaac Roert, Ben Cuter, Jovan Harris, and Eamon Smith were second in the distant medley relay. About 3 seconds behind Ames, Clear Creek Amano was third. Now going to the girls' events at the Drake Relays. Kinney hits overdrive late, wins girls 1500 by Jeff Linder, Dateline Des Moines. By all appearances, with a lap to go, Ashlyn Kinney was fading and perhaps finished. Turns out she was just getting started. Kinney found a second wind, an overdrive, and blistered to a 67-second final lap to capture the Drake Relays 1500-meter championship Thursday afternoon at Drake Stadium. The junior from Iowa City Liberty overtook Ballard's Shaway Johnson in the final curve and won going away in 4 minutes, 39.24 seconds. With a lap left, I noticed Johnson was getting closer to the pack, said Keeney, who won her second Drake title. She was the 3,000-meter champ in 2019. I didn't know if I could catch her, but I was going to try. I figured, if I die, I die. Thankfully, I didn't. Keeney ran second to Johnson for the first half of the race, then was overtaken by one runner and then another. With a lap to go, she was in fifth, well behind Johnson and heading in the wrong direction in the standings, and then she found her kick. I tried to stick with the pack around me, but I got boxed in, she said. I tried to go outside so I could get back in the race, and then I was going to stay there. Keeney figured to be a contender in the 3002, but I had been having some shin pain, so I thought the best I could do was two races. She also anchored the sprint medley race, and I'm glad I did. I can't believe I won. They handed me the flag and thought, what? Keeney was the lone girls' winner. Western Dubuque's Audrey Bierman was the 400-meter runner-up. Her 56.99-second effort was second to Carlisle's Ainsley Erzin at 56.28. On the backstretch, I paced myself and I tried to stay close to Cedar Rapids Prairie's Gabby Cortez, Bierman said. When there was 100 left, I kicked as hard as I could. North Cedar's Kelly Proche more than held her own against Waukee's powerhouse hurdlers. Proche was third in the 100-meter hurdles at 52.12 seconds and fourth in the 400 hurdles at 1:05, Waukee's Mackenzie Carney won both races. I'm so excited. This was so cool, Proche said. Those Waukee girls, I respect them so much, and it was definitely good for me to go up against them and see how I measured up. Only one girls' race was held between the two open hurdles races. I didn't even warm up, the second time, Proche said. When I do that, it just wears me down. I just rehydrated, and I was ready to go again. Solon's Emma Bach was third in the 800 in 2 minutes and 15 seconds. I was trying to follow the girls that run in the 2:17s and then see how I felt at the end, Bach said. Cortez was fifth in the 400 and anchored Prairie to third place in the sprint medley relay, fifth in the 3,200-meter relay. In girls' soccer, Tate notches game winner for West by Nathan Ford, Dateline, Iowa City. The ball hit the back of the net with 7 minutes and 5 seconds remaining last night at Ed Barker Soccer Complex, and Iowa City West's Mina Tate looked like she didn't know what to do next. I was really surprised, Tate said. When I shot it, I wasn't even thinking. As Tate collected a pass from Grace Curran at the top of the box, turned into open space and fired, she looked like a veteran center forward who had scored dozens of goals in her career, not a sophomore midfielder notching her first high school goal in her team's biggest rivalry game. It was the first and only goal of the night as Class 3A number 13 Iowa City West beat number 9 Iowa City High 1-0. I saw she overplayed me, so I turned the other way, and then everything was just open. Nobody was there, Tate said. I thought if I just kick it hard, it will probably go in. Just as unlikely as Tate might have thought scoring herself was, it looked like the Trojans might not even produce that kind of a chance early in the match. City High controlled the first part of the game, and Julia Bernat, who West coach David Rosenthal called the team's most improved player, came up with multiple diving saves to keep it scoreless. Something changed at halftime. It was West, with players like Tate, McKenna Vonderhaar, and Jada Dackler, stepping up to take control of the midfield, West making key one-on-one defensive plays, and West taking the first 5 shots after the break. This particular team is one of the better teams I've had in my 27 years of responding to coaching, Rosenthal said. It showed. The Trojans were thumped 5-0 Tuesday night at Linmar, which is ranked number 3 in 3A in the first state rankings released Thursday, but regrouped quickly. I think there's a good mental toughness to them, Rosenthal said. It makes a difference in games like this. With 10 seconds left, West also needed to get one last ball away from speedy City High forward Claire Brown. It was Tate who swept it out of danger. We knew we could win, and we should win, Tate said. Now turning to the editorial page, Insight, we turn to At Liberty, Adam Sullivan's column, Third-Party Hopes to Expand Reach. A trans woman, a racial justice activist, a former Democrat, and a lifelong libertarian, walked into a Libertarian Party of Iowa convention last week. Libertarianism is often seen as a right-wing movement, but Iowa's third-largest political party is working to shake the reputation. Party leaders hope to chart a more inclusive path beyond the stereotypical conservative-to-libertarian pipeline. At their annual convention last week in Cedar Rapids, party organizers invited me to moderate a panel discussion focused on libertarian outreach outside the usual networks of the liberty movement. Jenny Cadle, a member of the gender and sexual minority community, lamented that the political left gets credit for issues where they fail to deliver. We're going to drop bombs, but on the side of the bombs is going to be a rainbow flag for pride. They're able to sell this even though they don't follow up or do anything, Cadle said. Jules Offenbach, a Russian immigrant and former candidate for Iowa Secretary of State, said she voted for Barack Obama in 2008 because he promised to end wars, curtail the Patriot Act, and close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. When he failed to deliver, she sought out other options and found the Libertarian Party. I was not going to vote for someone who has done absolutely nothing on the 3 issues that are important to me in the last 4 years, and I was certainly not voting for Sarah Palin, Offenbach said. David Green, member of the Libertarian State Central Committee, said the libertarian movement has always been his political home. I've been libertarian since birth, but they didn't have a party all those years ago, Green said. For as long as there has been an American liberties movement, there has been a libertarian in there has been libertarian infighting. There has always been a subset of the movement bent on courting prejudice and white grievance. In the early 1990s, the radical political theorist Murray Rothbard struck an alliance with right-wing populists and defended the white supremacist politician David Duke. His writing from the era reads like a proto-Trumpism. Quote, America first. Quote, defend family values. Quote, unleash the cops to clear the streets of bums and vagrants. Unquote. Rothbard drew a line separating his libertarianism from the Koch brothers' libertarianism, which he wrongly decried as leaning toward cultural and social leftism and a libertine lifestyle. In the 30 years since, the Koch version, more inclusive and socially open than Rothbard's, has thrived in comparison. Libertarianism is not a bigoted philosophy, but it sometimes attracts bigots. Some in the movement are determined to sweep the ugly bits of our intellectual history under the rug, but we must not. We must acknowledge it, reject it, and root out its remnants. At the convention last week, Abina Imhotep, a black woman and 2018 candidate for the party's lieutenant governor nomination, challenged members to build a more diverse party. If the party doesn't want to be seen as the party of white dudes who smoke weed, then where's the black dudes who smoke weed? There are plenty of brothers out there who smoke weed. The point is, talk about it and then be about it, Imhotep said. And that is Adam Sullivan's column at Liberty. Another guest column is titled A Call for More Change in Cedar Rapids by Ann Harris Carter. Change is always around us and within us. Whether fast or slow, change is often inevitable. In fact, my most meaningful growth experiences, personal and professional, have come along when I embrace change with grace. That could be said of Cedar Rapids also. This week, Tam Marcus announced she is running for the City Council District 3 seat. A former Fulbright scholar and recipient of multiple fellowships, Tam serves as the first sustainability program manager for Linn County. At the beginning of 2020, she was preparing to head to Sweden to pursue her research in environmental change. But with the pandemic, those plans changed. Instead of continuing her PhD research on location, she returned to Cedar Rapids, where she had graduated from Kennedy High School before completing college and beginning postgraduate studies. I am grateful that the disruption afforded me the opportunity to work alongside Tam, who also serves as president and co-founder of Advocates for Social Justice. My involvement with the grassroots organization came when ASJ leaders and the city representatives were deliberating seven demands to bring about racial equity. Initial discussions were tense, but ultimately, in less than 1 month, City Council unanimously approved a resolution supporting all seven items. I then became part of the ASJ subgroup that worked with city staff over several months to design a citizen review board ordinance, which in February the City Council also approved unanimously. I witnessed Tam's tenacity and diplomacy and was impressed time and again with her command of issues new to her. She also was instrumental in building widespread community relationships to advance the work of ASJ. I want to be clear that the District 3 seat is one of three seats that will be up for re-election in November. The incumbent is the Venerable Dale Todd. Over the years, Dale has served the city as council member, commissioner of parks and public property, and dozens of community groups. Dale is admired, and rightfully so. In fact, he has been very supportive of my family. Dale also coached me on engaging in local initiatives when I came back to Cedar Rapids. Considering the change that is underway with matters of social equity and the issues of our local economy and environment, I am convinced it is time for change in District 3. I am supporting Tam and would love to see Dale support her also. Tam possesses the intellect, civic experience, and community orientation to anticipate the needs of Cedar Rapidians. My favorite definition of leadership is influence, which I have adapted from author John Maxwell. In a very short time, TAM has not only influenced me, but many others throughout our region. I am proud to recognize her as part of the movement of young adults who are committed to accelerating the pace of change. And that guest column is by Anne Harris Carter. And there is also the Gazette editorial. Fix the recount process. It's been more than 3 weeks since Democrat Rita Hart ended her bid for a congressional probe into the 2020 second district election she lost by 6 votes. Anyone who watched the saga unfold knows it uncovered flaws in Iowa's recount process. The timeline allowed for evaluating Hart's state recount request in a race that drew more than 400,000 votes was unduly compressed. If she had asked state judges to review the certified outcome, a December deadline would have given them just days to review the election. It seems like a system geared more toward settling county or legislative races than a congressional or statewide race. Counties' procedures were not uniform, and election boards lacked the personnel needed to take on the job. Ballots legally cast but excluded by error could not be counted. This looks like a job for the Iowa legislature. Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, Democrat of Coralville, has called for bipartisan legislative leadership to come together behind recount changes before the current legislative session ends. Earlier in the session, Republicans who control the legislature said they wouldn't consider changes while Hart continued her recount effort. That's over, but GOP leaders are noncommittal on whether changes will be taken up. Maybe they can be incorporated into a pending bill containing non-controversial technical election law changes. Or maybe not. Some lawmakers want to wait until next year, but by then congressional contests will already be underway and election year partisanship could make even common sense changes less attractive. Lawmakers should act now while the lessons of the second district contest are fresh in our minds and before partisanship makes a bipartisan package far less possible. For all the dubious claims we've heard about the need to protect election integrity this session, the need to fix Iowa's recount process is no fiction. There's no reason to believe Iowa won't face excruciatingly close elections in the future. Iowa's 1st, 2nd, and 3rd districts could be hotly contested again in 2022, depending on the outcome of the delayed redistricting process. Voters deserve legislation and legislative action that makes it more likely their votes will be counted and their intent will be certified by a fair, transparent process. And that is the Gazette's editorial from the Insight page. There is also a letter to the editor by DPO Executive Board Dana Van Abima, Chad Meacham, Alyssa Pallant, Noor Miller, Stevie Toomey, Angela Pruitt, Michael Tilley, Kelly Brenneman, and Maka Pilcher. In recognition of National Teacher Appreciation Week, May 3rd through 7th, the Iowa City Community School District District-wide Parents Organization would like to thank the amazing teachers, teacher librarians, and other district and Grant Wood AEA employees who work with our children. This year has been incomparable in the challenges it has brought, and our teachers have overcome those many challenges with passion and grace. During the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, educators have at times risked their health and gone above and beyond to maintain a stable, supportive presence in the lives of ICCSD students. We also congratulate this year's DPO scholarship recipients, Grace Brokaw from West High, Amelia Gibson from City High, Raphael Hamilton from City High. DPO scholarships are awarded each year to select seniors from the ICCSD who have expressed an interest in teaching. This year's pool of motivated and accomplished applicants bodes well for the future of the teaching profession. DPO scholarships are funded by donations from parent groups at ICCSD schools and others who nominate retiring teachers and other honorees connected to our district. We would like to thank everyone who put forward an honoree this year and helped fund these important scholarships. The tradition of celebrating the impact and legacy of these wonderful teachers and other district employees is a great honor for the DPO. To those teachers who are retiring this year, please know you will be missed, but your impact will live on in countless ways. We wish you well in the next phase of your lives. And that's from the DPO Executive Board, Danavan Abima, Chad Meacham, Alyssa Palante, Noor Miller, Stevie Toomey, Angela Pruitt, Michael Tilley, Kelly Brenneman, and Maka Pilcher. See Our Man Sentenced to Over 5 Years for Bank Fraud by Trish Mahaffey. A Cedar Rapids man who was a former president of People's Trust and Savings Bank in Riverside
was sentenced this week to more than 5 years in federal prison for bank and wire fraud and ordered to pay over $1 million in restitution to 4 financial institutions. U.S. District Judge Stephanie Rose sentenced Christopher M. Gert, 40, to 69 months for bank fraud, wire fraud, aggravated identity theft, and misapplication by bank officer, Tuesday in federal court in Davenport. Gert also must serve 5 years of supervised release after his prison term and pay more than $1.2 million in restitution to County Bank, People's Trust and Savings Bank, Farm Bureau Financial Services, and Everest Insurance. This investigation began as early as 2006 when Gert participated in fraudulent activities at multiple financial institutions. He started with People's in 2012 and was appointed president and chief executive officer and a member of the board of directors, according to court documents. He resigned from the bank December 16, 2015. During his time at the bank, he was the sole loan officer and primarily worked out of the branch office in Riverside. Gert obtained and used an unauthorized credit card in the bank's name for his personal use, according to court documents. He charged over $89,000 on the card in 3 years and also diverted loan proceeds from bank customers to make payments on the credit card, the indictment filed in 2019 said. Gert also falsified loan documents, altered appraisals, made false statements to investigators, and obtained loans without the knowledge of customers, according to court documents. Gert knew he was being investigated and continued his pattern of deception by seeking a job that would allow him to commit additional fraud at Farm Bureau Financial Services. The indictment said he was a contracted insurance agent for both Farm Bureau Property and Casualty and Farm Bureau Life Company from about February 1, 2017 through January 24, 2018. Gert solicited customers to sign up for insurance with his company, receiving bonuses for obtaining policies. Gert also was an officer and employee of the county bank in March 2016 and embezzled or misapplied over $2,000 from one customer and applied it to another's account without authorization, according to the indictment. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 23rd, 2021. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.